Welcome to Pilgrim Radio's Reader's Choice. We invite you to join us for the next 30 minutes as together we open the pages of a good book. And now, here's your reader with more information.
Hello, I'm Pamela Fitch, and it's good to have you with us as we begin reading the book Mere Christianity, a great classic by C.S. Lewis, published by HarperCollins in 1980. And we'll begin today with the foreword written by his stepson, Douglas Gresham. Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, better known by his family and close friends as Jack, has become one of the most respected and indeed almost revered books of the 20th century. And now, as we, some of us reluctantly, stagger into the so far chaotic 21st century, the need for it has never been more dire. For such a renowned and powerful book, it has a somewhat strange origin. At the beginning of 1941, Britain and her empire stood alone at war with Nazi Germany. Britain's cities were being pounded into rubble by Germany's Luftwaffe. And at this time of imminent personal and national peril, the thoughts of the nation began to look outward from earth, seeking solace, or at least reassurance, that somehow there would be some sense made of the horror that surrounded them. The stalwart voice to which the people of Britain turned for this reassurance was that of the already world-famous British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC. The BBC, in the person of James Welch, who was at that time director of religious broadcasting, was already becoming aware of Jack's prowess as a clear and direct speaker and writer. His book, The Problem of Pain, and his series of the Screwtape Letters, which had appeared in The Guardian, as well as his lectures to the Royal Air Force personnel, by request of the RAF's chaplain-in-chief, Maurice Edwards, which took Jack all over England, had begun to be known and recognized as hugely valuable. So early in 1941, Dr. Welch approached Jack and asked him to deliver a series of talks addressed to the people of England. Those talks soon became hugely popular amongst audiences all across the spectrum of Britain's then widely divided class system. Aristocrats and academics would tune in religiously, as would clubs and pubs. Many years later, one man told me of his own experience in the public bar of a working man's pub, when the crowd of men in the bar were all hurriedly shushed as Jack was introduced on the bar wireless and began to speak to a silent and intent group of laborers, farm workers, and other working men. Despite the huge burden of work that Jack had undertaken at this time, he was able to speak lucidly and entertainingly about very difficult and important matters, holding any audience, irrespective of their personal beliefs or lack of them, and able to cut across the dark barriers of denominational divisions like the sword of an angel tearing through the temple curtain in Jerusalem. The BBC was thrilled at the success of the talks, and Jack was persuaded to deliver 3 further series of them over the next few years. Jack traveled back and forth to RAF stations around the country and repeatedly to London, all through the hard, savage years of that first critical phase of the war, making his way through blacked-out streets, air raids, and the horror of burning London, dutifully delivering his talks live over and over again, and escaping each time physically unscathed. He told me many years later that his chief personal memories of the Second World War were of always being grindingly tired, tired and desperately cold, standing on aching feet in the freezing corridors of unheated trains, crowded with fighting men on their way either home for leave or to God alone knew what kinds of hell. The talks were so successful that Jack was almost buried in letters from people saying how much they had benefited from them, and others asking questions or requesting copies of the scripts. So heavy became the burden of correspondence and requests that Jack decided to publish the talks in book form. He tidied them up a bit, and soon the first slim volume, Broadcast Talks, The Case for Christianity in the United States, appeared on bookshop shelves in 1942. Almost as soon as the following series of talks were broadcast, the second volume was released. This one was titled Christian Behavior and made its debut in 1943. This second small book was followed in due course by Beyond Personality in 1944. All the while that Jack was writing and delivering these series of talks, he was journeying all over England, distributing hope to young men, mostly little more than boys. The average age was about 21, and many were still in their late teens, who faced daily the dangers of the Battle of Britain or deep forays into enemy-held territory on bombing raids. Spending most of each weekend in the darkened, bitterly cold, crowded trains of wartime England, he spent all his weekdays lecturing throughout Oxford and occasionally elsewhere, tutoring students, marking up exam papers, and working the full-time life of a university don, while also writing what he knew needed to be written. His talks, being but a minor part of what he worked on, and managing his busy household under very difficult conditions. There's little wonder that Winston Churchill offered him a knighthood when it was all over, for there are many kinds of heroes in times of war, and many of them, perhaps even most of them, are not always found in the fields of battle. Jack declined the honor because, as he told me in the late 1950s, he did not think it right to accept an honor for a task that it was his duty to perform. It has often and erroneously been said that no good ever comes from a war, but there are very few who would dispute that Jack's life, career, and influence have been anything but good for the world and those of us who must live in these times. And were it not for the First World War, Jack would never have been able to study at Oxford because he was completely unable to pass the maths part of the Responsions entrance exam. And it was waived for the few enough soldiers returning from that horrific conflict. Also, had there never been the Second World War, it is doubtful that you or anyone else would ever have been able to hold and then to read the volume that lies before you. This very book will help to explain its own strange origins, and that no matter how hard the enemy of God and man tears at us and through us rends our world and its people, God will always bring some counteractive good from the rubble that we leave in the wake of our evil. This very book is evidence of the power of mere Christianity. Douglas Gresham, January 6th, 2012, Malta. And now we begin the preface, written by C.S. Lewis, in explanation of his approach to the writing of the book. The contents of this book were first given on the air and then published in three separate parts as Broadcast Talks, 1942, Christian Behavior, 1943, and Beyond Personality, 1944. In the printed versions, I made a few additions to what I had said at the microphone, but otherwise left the text much as it had been. A talk on the radio should, I think, be as like real talk as possible, and should not sound like an essay being read aloud. In my talks, I had therefore used all the contractions and colloquialisms I ordinarily use in conversation. In the printed version, I reproduce this, putting don't and we've for do not and we have. And wherever in the talks I had made the importance of a word clear by the emphasis of my voice, I printed it in italics. I'm now inclined to think that this was a mistake, an undesirable hybrid between the art of speaking and the art of writing. A talker ought to use variations of voice for emphasis because his medium naturally lends itself to that method. But a writer ought not to use italics for the same purpose. He has his own different means of bringing out the key words and ought to use them. In this edition, I've expanded the contractions and replaced most of the italics by a recasting of the sentences in which they occurred, but without altering, I hope, the popular or familiar tone which I had all along intended. I've also added and deleted where I thought I understood any part of my subject better now than 10 years ago, or where I knew that the original version had been misunderstood by others. The reader should be warned that I offer no help to anyone who's hesitating between two Christian denominations. You will not learn from me whether you ought to become an Anglican, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, or a Roman Catholic. This omission is intentional. Even in the list I've just given, the order is alphabetical. There is no mystery about my own position. I am a very ordinary layman of the Church of England, not especially high, nor especially low, nor especially anything else. But in this book, I'm not trying to convert anyone to my own position. Ever since I became a Christian, I have thought that the best, perhaps the only service I could do for my unbelieving neighbors was to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times. I had more than one reason for thinking this. In the first place, the questions which divide Christians from one another often involve points of high theology or even of ecclesiastical history, which ought never to be treated except by real experts. I should have been out of my depth in such waters, more in need of help myself than able to help others. And secondly, I think we must admit that the discussion of these disputed points has no tendency at all to bring an outsider into the Christian fold. So long as we write and talk about them, we're much more likely to deter him from entering any Christian communion than to draw him into our own. Our divisions should never be discussed except in the presence of those who have already come to believe that there is one God and that Jesus Christ is his only Son. Finally, I got the impression that far more and more talented authors were already engaged in such controversial matters than in the defense of what Baxter calls mere Christianity. That part of the line where I thought I could serve best was also the part that seemed to be thinnest, and to it, I naturally went. So far as I know, these were my only motives, and I should be very glad if people would not draw fanciful inferences from my silence on certain disputed matters. For example, such silence need not mean that I myself am sitting on the fence. Sometimes I am. There are questions at issue between Christians to which I do not think we've been told the answer. There are some to which I may never know the answer. If I ask them, even in a better world, I might, for all I know, be answered, as a far greater questioner was answered, "What is that to thee? Follow thou me." But there are other questions as to which I am definitely on one side of the fence, and yet say nothing. For I am not writing to expound something I could call my religion, but to expound mere Christianity, which is what it is and what it was long before I was born, and whether I like it or not. Some people draw unwarranted conclusions from the fact that I never say more about the Blessed Virgin Mary than is involved in asserting the virgin birth of Christ. But surely my reason for not doing so is obvious. To say more would take me at once into highly controversial regions, and there is no controversy between Christians which needs to be so delicately touched as this. The Roman Catholic beliefs on that subject are held not only with the ordinary fervor that attaches to all sincere religious belief, but very naturally with the peculiar and, as it were, chivalrous sensibility that a man feels when the honor of his mother or his beloved is at stake. It is very difficult so to dissent from them that you will not appear to them as a cad as well as a heretic. And contrarywise, the opposed Protestant beliefs on this subject call forth feelings which go down to the very roots of all monotheism, whatever. To radical Protestants, it seems that the distinction between creator and creature, however holy, is imperiled, that polytheism is risen again. Hence, it is hard so to dissent from them that you will not appear something worse than a heretic, a pagan. If any topic could be relied upon to wreck a book about mere Christianity, if any topic makes utterly unprofitable reading for those who do not yet believe that the Virgin's Son is God, surely this is it. Oddly enough, you cannot even conclude from my silence on disputed points either that I think them important or that I think them unimportant. For this is itself one of the disputed points. One of the things Christians are disagreed about is the importance of their disagreements. When two Christians of different denominations start arguing, it is usually not long before one asks whether such and such a point really matters, and the other replies, "Matter? Why, it's absolutely essential." All this is said simply in order to make clear what kind of book I was trying to write, not in the least to conceal or evade responsibility for my own beliefs. About those, as I said before, there is no secret. To quote Uncle Toby, they are written in the common prayer book. The danger clearly was that I should put forward as common Christianity anything that was peculiar to the Church of England, or, worse still, to myself. I tried to guard against this by sending the original script of what is now Book 2 to four clergymen, an Anglican, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, and a Roman Catholic, asking for their criticism. The Methodist thought I had not said enough about faith, and the Roman Catholic thought I'd gone rather too far about the comparative unimportance of theories and explanation of the atonement. Otherwise, all five of us were agreed. I did not have the remaining books similarly vetted because in them, though differences might arise among Christians, these would be differences between individuals or schools of thought and not between denominations. So far as I can judge from reviews and from the numerous letters written to me, the book, however faulty in other respects, did at least succeed in presenting an agreed or common or central or mere Christianity. In that way, it may possibly be of some help in silencing the view that if we omit the disputed points, we shall have left only a vague and bloodless HCF. The HCF turns out to be something not only positive, but pungent, divided from all non-Christian beliefs by a chasm to which the worst divisions inside Christendom are not really comparable at all. And referring back to the HCF abbreviation, there are two schools of thought. One is for the meaning being holy Catholic faith, and the legitimization is found in the contextual placement of that abbreviation. And the other side of the coin would be HCF for highest common factor. And if you would like more information on that, you can simply Google HCF and make that decision for yourself. If I have not directly helped the cause of reunion, I've perhaps made it clear why we ought to be reunited. Certainly, I have met with little of the fabled odium theologicum from convinced members of communions different from my own. Hostility has come more from borderline people, whether within the Church of England or without it, men not exactly obedient to any communion. This I find curiously consoling. It is at her center where her truest children dwell, that each communion is really closest to every other in spirit, if not in doctrine. And this suggests that at the center of each, there is a something or a someone who, against all divergences of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution, speaks with the same voice. So much for my omissions on doctrine. In Book 3, which deals with morals, I have also passed over some things in silence, but for a different reason. Ever since I served as an infantryman in the First World War, I have had a great dislike of people who themselves, in ease and safety, issue exhortations to men in the front line. As a result, I have a reluctance to say much about temptations to which I myself am not exposed. No man, I suppose, is tempted to every sin. It so happens that the impulse which makes men gamble has been left out of my makeup, and no doubt I pay for this by lacking some good impulse of which it is the excess or perversion. I therefore did not feel myself qualified to give advice about permissible and impermissible gambling, if there is any permissible, for I do not claim to know even that. I've also said nothing about birth control. I'm not a woman, nor even a married man, nor am I a priest. I did not think it my place to take a firm line about pains, dangers, and expenses from which I am protected, having no pastoral office which obliged me to do so. Far deeper objections may be felt and have been expressed against my use of the word Christian to mean one who accepts the common doctrines of Christianity. People ask, who are you to lay down who is and who is not a Christian? Or, may not many a man who cannot believe these doctrines be far more truly a Christian, far closer to the Spirit of Christ, than some who do? Now, this objection is in one sense very right, very charitable, very spiritual, very sensitive. It has every available quality except that of being useful. We simply cannot, without disaster, use language as these objectors want us to use it. And I will try to make this clear by the history of another and very much less important word. The word gentleman originally meant something recognizable, one who had a coat of arms and some landed property. When you call someone a gentleman, you were not paying him a compliment, but merely stating a fact. If you said he was not a gentleman, you were not insulting him, but giving information. There was no contradiction in saying that John was a liar and a gentleman, any more than there now is in saying that James is a fool and an M.A. But then there came people who said so rightly, charitably, spiritually, sensitively, so anything but usefully, ah, but surely the important thing about a gentleman is not the coat of arms and the land, but the behavior? Surely he is the true gentleman who behaves as a gentleman should. Surely, in that sense, Edward is far more truly a gentleman than John. They meant well. To be honorable and courteous and brave is, of course, a far better thing than to have a coat of arms, but it is not the same thing. Worse still, it is not a thing everyone will agree about. To call a man a gentleman in this new, refined sense becomes, in fact, not a way of giving information about him, but a way of praising him. To deny that he is a gentleman becomes simply a way of insulting him. When a word ceases to be a term of description and becomes merely a term of praise, it no longer tells you facts about the object, it only tells you about the speaker's attitude to that object. A nice meal only means a meal the speaker likes. A gentleman, once it has been spiritualized and refined out of its old, coarse, objective sense, means hardly more than a man whom the speaker likes. As a result, gentleman is now a useless word. We had lots of terms of approval already, so it was not needed for that use. On the other hand, if anyone, say, in a historical work, wants to use it in its old sense, he cannot do so without explanations. It has been spoiled for that purpose. Now, if once we allow people to start spiritualizing and refining, or as they might say, deepening the sense of the word Christian, it too will speedily become a useless word. In the first place, Christians themselves will never be able to apply it to anyone. It is not for us to say who, in the deepest sense, is or is not close to the Spirit of Christ. We do not see into men's hearts. We cannot judge, and are indeed forbidden to judge. It would be wicked arrogance for us to say that any man is or is not a Christian in this refined sense. And obviously, a word which we can never apply is not going to be a very useful word. As for unbelievers, they will no doubt cheerfully use the word in the refined sense. It will become in their mouths simply a term of praise. In calling anyone a Christian, they will mean that they think him a good man. But that way of using the word will be no enrichment of the language, for we already have the word good. Meanwhile, the word Christian will have been spoiled for any really useful purpose it might have served. We must therefore stick to the original, obvious meaning. The name Christians was first given at Antioch, Acts 11:26, to the disciples, to those who accepted the teaching of the apostles. There is no question of its being restricted to those who profited by that teaching as much as they should have. There is no question of it being extended to those who, in some refined spiritual inward fashion, were far closer to the Spirit of Christ than the less satisfactory of these disciples. The point is not a theological or moral one. It is only a question of using words so that we can all understand what is being said. When a man who accepts the Christian doctrine lives unworthily of it, it is much clearer to say that he is a bad Christian than to say he is not a Christian. And this is where we'll stop for today on page Roman numeral 12 of the preface of Mere Christianity, published by HarperCollins in 1980. Thanks for joining me, and God bless you until we meet again.
You've been listening to Reader's Choice, featuring good books from the Christian classics to the latest releases in half-hour installments. To find out about other programs on Pilgrim Radio, visit our website at pilgrimradio.com or request a free program guide by emailing info@pilgrimradio.com. And join us again next time for Reader's Choice.